Well, greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour. Now, the Law Hour is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is heard nationally 7 days a week on Truth Radio and worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Great American Trials right after this message. Well, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity, and we've been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals, like bankers, to manage our financial affairs, and doctors to manage and treat our health problems, and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs, instead of relying upon our own good common sense. Now, it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. And you can order yours by calling direct, 417-273-4967. If you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click on the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Great American Trials. Vera Stets. Well, she put on her coat. She went up two flights of stairs to her boyfriend, her lover. We don't know whether Vera ever had sexual relations with the good doctor or not. It appears from the trial that she did not, that she was a clean, wholesome woman. She had a desire to marry this guy. She was waiting for him to divorce his wife so that she could marry him. Now, she may have been having an affair with him. We can't tell that for certain, but here's the rest of the story. At 2:30 a.m., shots were heard in Beekman Towers, and the police were called. Well, they discovered Vera Stets sitting on the stairway just below the third floor. In her large handbag, they found a .32 caliber revolver and a box of bullets, two spent shells, and a crumpled silk nightgown with fresh, wet bloodstains. "Did you shoot the man upstairs?" the police asked. "Yes, I did," sobbed Stets. "But please don't ask me why I did it," she said. She was on the way to turn herself in. Well, the police grilled her for hours, but she would say nothing more. All she said was, "Yes, I did, but please don't ask me why I did it. Yes, I did, but please don't ask me why I did it." Now, her father, Frank Stets, sent for Samuel Leibowitz, who had defended the Scottsboro boys and was known as the best criminal lawyer in the country. The newspapers called Stets the icy blonde because she would not talk. They dug up Gebhardt's background. He had been a pilot in World War I's famed Richthofen squadron. He was a friend of pilot Hermann Göring. He held doctorates in both philosophy and political economy. He had made $500,000 in international business deals, but had made the mistake, from Nazi Germany's point of view, of marrying a non-Aryan. He had, however, moved out, leaving her with two children and no divorce. Well, Vera Stretz tells what happened. When the trial began on March 20th, 1936, defense attorney Leibowitz probed each juror's knowledge of Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, the German philosopher whose idea of a super race attracted Adolf Hitler, and who said, "Man shall be trained for war, and woman for the recreation of the warrior. All else," he said, "is folly." Well, then, with Vera Stretz on the stand for 13 hours, Leibowitz carefully produced testimony on Gebhardt's attitude toward marriage and toward her. And when she announced the night of November 11th that she would not continue their relationship, she testified, "Gebhardt had thrown her on the bed and raped her. Next, laughing at her and saying, 'If you want to make it the last night, you will have to make it a good one,' he demanded that she perform an act of sodomy so foreign to her and so shameful that she had been unable to tell the police. But now she recounted it. At the insistence of Judge Cornelius Collins, only through violent, uncontrollable sobbing, recalling seeing a gun in Gebhardt's chest of drawers when she looked for his heating pad, she seized it. The doctor crying, 'You damned whore, I will kill you,' and he grabbed at the gun," she said. "It went off. He fell on the bed. He got up. He lunged at her again, and she shot again in self-defense." Prosecutor Miles O'Brien cross-examined her for 4 hours. "She killed," he insisted, "in a hot fever of jealousy because Gebhardt wouldn't give up his wife for her. She is a tigress when provoked." But he was unable to produce a single contradiction in Stretz's testimony. Well, the judge's charge lasted 5 hours, defining first-degree murder, second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, and reasonable doubt, excusable homicide, and justifiable homicide. "If you believe her story," he finished acidly, "acquit her." Well, within 3 hours, the jury did just that. And the furious judge went to his chambers without even thanking the jury for their services. The next day, Stretz met the press. "Don't let this ruin your life," said a woman reporter. "My life is already ruined," said Vera Stretz. Years later, the defendant in this trial was identified only as one Laura Parr. When and how her name was changed from Vera Stretz remains a secret, buried with her ruined life. Well, there's the story of Vera Stretz, a very different outcome from the same crime. Well, let's analyze it. Vera was having an affair. Adultery. Well, we don't know positively that she was having an affair. That is, she was having sexual relations, but she was seeing the doctor. And, of course, on the outside, remember this is the 1930s, at least on the outside for public consumption, she wasn't advertising that she was playing the harlot or that she was having an affair. And she wanted to get married. And remember that when the police asked her if she killed the man upstairs, she said, "Yes, but don't ask me why I do it." And after questioning for hours, she would never reveal. She never told her story. And when the case went to trial, the prosecuting attorney heard her story, 13 hours of it, for the first time. And instead of hours and hours and days with many, many police witnesses to take her statements and to talk to her and to coach her and to twist her story, They never had an opportunity to do that to her. He had 4 hours to cross-examine her. She stuck with her story. They heard her story for the first time. She stuck with her story. And she claimed that it was self-defense. There were no other witnesses against Vera Stretz. You see, in most cases, the witnesses against the defendant are the police. And the police are testifying to the contradictions in the story of the defendant. Notice in the Stretz case, there were no witnesses against Vera. She was the only witness. She was the only one that was there. The doctor was dead. He couldn't testify as to what happened. Nobody else was in the room. They couldn't testify to what happened. Vera didn't talk to the police, so they had nothing to testify against her. They had a body, they had a gun, and they had a confession. Yes, I killed him. Ah. But the conclusion of the jury was, he needed killing. Did he or didn't he? Well, let me tell you a little story here. My mentor, Ben Rice, the attorney from Kuhn, Idaho, defended a murder case in Caldwell, Idaho, in which a woman took a shotgun out of the closet. Her husband was eating breakfast at the kitchen table. She walked up behind him while he was eating breakfast, raised the gun, and about 6 inches from the back of his head, pulled the trigger and blew his head right off. Well, the top half of it. Then she called the police. She was arrested and jailed. Ben came out to defend the case. The jury came back, and they found that she was not guilty. She had been charged with murder. The jury came back and found that she not only wasn't guilty, but the jury, when they were polled, to a man said he needed killing. Now, what happened in that case? Why would a jury come back and a self-confessed murderer exonerate the crime and say he needed killing? And as Paul Harvey would say, that's the rest of the story. And you know, oftentimes it's the rest of the story that never gets told to the jury, never gets told to the court, because a defendant does take the stand. And by and large, that's the fact whenever this right goes. Back, everyone. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by Truth Radio Network. All of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Well, many of the lessons that you hear on The Law Hour are just a small part of my two-week school on courtroom strategy and procedure, and these classes include lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive a complaint, summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits into evidence, and write motions, briefs, and affidavits. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom either. You'll learn preliminary procedures such as arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn them all here at the law school in this class. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call direct, 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. Remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Now, in addition to that, courtroom strategy and procedure is available on compact disc for home education if you want to study at home. And if you're online, you can go to the website, georgegordon.org, click onto the email, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, in the Vera Stretz case, Vera did something that was unusual for criminal defendants. She confessed to the crime and then shut up. So indeed, we did have a crime. We've got a victim. We've got the murder weapon. We charge her with the murder, but the police never get the story from her. She never tells them any more than what she had told them. And when she finally told her story, she told her story for the first time in court to the jury. So the judge heard it for the first time. The police heard it for the first time. The prosecutor heard it for the first time. And we presume that her defense lawyer, her defense attorney, had heard it for the 35th time. In this way, there were no witnesses to come in and contradict Vera or to point out that she was a liar, that she had said one thing at one time, that in her statement to the police she'd said this or that or something else, and that there were police witnesses who could come in and testify to the various versions of her story, impeach her credibility, destroy her defense, and convict her. And had she talked to the police, she would most certainly have been convicted because she never could have told that story twice. So because she followed Rule 1, that is, she kept her mouth shut, she didn't say anything, and she shut up. And I told you about a similar case that I learned from my mentor, Ben Rice. Now, the rest of the story was this. The husband had been exceedingly abusive to his wife over a period of many years. Just like O.J. Simpson was physically abusive to his wife over a period of many years. Many calls had been made to the sheriff and the police. Many times the neighbors had reported that this woman had been beaten. They had seen her many times with black eyes and that she had cuts and abrasions on her. Well, she too shut up. After she shot her husband's head off, and the police arrested her and took her to jail, charged her with murder, she hired Ben Rice, but she never said anything to the police about why she did it, like Vera Stretz. She didn't tell. She never contradicted herself on the witness stand, and she took the witness stand in her own defense. Now, here's another very unusual factor. Vera Stretz got on the witness stand and defended herself. Have you noticed that most criminal defendants don't take the witness stand in their own defense? Martha Stewart, for instance, did not take the witness stand in her own defense. Now, you have a constitutional right to remain silent. But, you see, most people misunderstand when it is that you should remain silent and when it is that you should speak. And so, in most cases, people willingly talk to the police for hours and hours, give statements in front of witnesses, and when the trial comes down, there are many police witnesses, many written statements concerning the events. And then the defendant does not take the witness stand in their own defense at the trial. And 94% of the time, they're convicted. The thing that surprises me is that they aren't convicted 100% of the time. Now, on the other hand, in the few cases where you have a defendant like a Verus Stratz, or you have a defendant like the one I'm describing here in Caldwell, Idaho, that get on the witness stand and tell their story for the very first time, there are no statements made against them. They get on the stand to testify. The husband, who is dead, cannot come in and testify. And the police cannot testify to any inconsistencies in her story or in her statement. They don't exist. And she tells her story for the first time. And if she can withstand cross-examination and the many witnesses who came in her defense and said that they had seen her with black eyes and bloodied, and that on that fateful morning, her husband had announced to her that when he finished breakfast, he was going to kill her. And she told the story through tears and great distress, how he had beaten her for many, many years, over and over again, and that she wanted to leave, but she didn't know how. And she took it, the beatings and the physical abuse for many, many years. And she made up her mind to live with it, and she would take her beating. But when her husband announced to her that after breakfast he was going to kill her, she was in such fear of her life that in self-defense, she killed her husband at the breakfast table. And the jury agreed. And when they came out, they said he needed killing. Now that's the difference between a successful defense and the ordinary defense, like we saw in Snyder-Jedd, which is very ordinary. And indeed, I'm not suggesting that Vera or the woman in Caldwell should run around killing their husbands. After all, if that was allowed to go on without some kind of sanction, why, we would have a lot of dead husbands and dead lovers, wouldn't we? Now, there's another interesting case that comes up. We'll get started on it. It'll take us a little bit longer than the 30 minutes that we have left, but I want to tell you a story about a great financier named Sam Insull. Sam Insull worked for Thomas Edison. And Sam Insull was the creator of, he was the first president of General Electric. And General Electric Corporation was started by Thomas Edison. And Thomas Edison was busy inventing, and he sent Insull up to, I think it was Schenectady, New York, to take over the fledgling General Electric Company, and he turned it into a multi-million dollar success. Then he went on to Chicago, and he built a great utility empire that ultimately collapsed in a Ponzi scheme. How could this great industrialist, this great business mind, have gotten himself involved in a Ponzi scheme? So we'll learn two lessons here, a history of great business success, and then we'll learn about the Ponzi scheme and the multi-level marketing programs that oftentimes, or in many, many cases, are illegal and unlawful. We'll learn what the basic rule of law is when you get into a business deal and you want to buy or sell to prevent yourself from being a victim of a Ponzi scheme, or if you want to buy and sell without getting yourself into trouble. There are certain rules that we have to follow. Well, Samuel Insull went on trial in 1934. The defendants were Samuel Insull Jr., Harold L. Stewart, and 13 others. And the crime charged was the use of the mails to defraud. The chief defense lawyers, Frederick Burnham, James J. Condon, Harry S. Ditchburn, and William H. Haight. The chief prosecutors, Dwight H. Green and Leslie Salter. Judge James Wilkerson. The place was Chicago, Illinois. The trial occurred in October and November of 1934. Verdict? Not guilty. Now, the significance of the case. Many people consider the Samuel Insull case to be the father of the Federal Securities and Exchange Act. The revelations of the trial produced immediate legislation to regulate the issuance of securities, control stock exchanges, and to protect the unwary from holding companies. The trial gives insight into a time when a stock manipulator could build a pyramid of commercial wealth, making as much as $1 million a week at the expense of thousands of small investors who were doomed innocently to financial ruin. Well, Samuel Insull was a 21-year-old Englishman in 1881 when inventor Thomas Alva Edison brought Insull to America as his private secretary. 11 years later, Insull was Edison's most trusted advisor, with discretion to handle all of the famous inventor's financial matters. In Schenectady, New York, the Edison General Electric Company was losing money. Edison dispatched Insull upstate, and he said, "Whatever you do, Sammy, make either a brilliant success of it or a brilliant failure. But do something, even if it's wrong." Well, within a few years after Insull took charge, the company had grown from 200 employees to 6,000. Soon, General Electric was the well-established General Electric Company, or GE. In 1892, Insull became president of Chicago Edison Company. He borrowed $250,000 from Marshall Field and began buying the independent electricity generating plants that were proliferating in Chicago. By 1907, his Commonwealth Edison Company served the entire city, and investors had put in hundreds of millions of dollars. Meantime, Insull acquired small electric companies in surrounding counties. Eventually, his Public Service Company of Northern Illinois served half the state, some 6,000 square miles. Insull built the world's largest generating plants with long transmission lines, reducing production costs and consumer rates, and increasing efficiency and profits. A reliable power pool, as he called it, it was entirely his idea. It supplied the network covering all of Chicago and northern and central Illinois. Insull was the Walmart of his time. By the 1920s, Insull had reorganized the near-bankrupt People's Gas, Light, and Coke Company, and its stock rose from $20 to $400 a share. He controlled Chicago's elevated rail lines and its commuter trolleys. His utilities companies operated in 39 of the 48 states. The man was worth more than $100 million to trusting investors. The name Insull was magic. In 1907, when Chicago banks refused to handle the unknown Commonwealth Edison Company security, Insull had found Halsey, Stewart and Company, and over the years, the firm headed by Harold L. Stewart had sold more than $2 billion of Insull property stock. Threatened with loss of control of the company, when the 1926 to 29 bull market saw new investment trusts buying up shares in his companies, Insull organized Insull Utility Investments Incorporated, and he and Halsey and Stewart would hold enough securities of the operating companies to keep him in control. The investment companies We're back for the closer. You're listening to The Law Hour. I'm your host, George Gordon. The Law Hour is sponsored by Truth Radio Network. It's an educational service in the public interest. Now, your support of Truth Radio Network and of our advertisers and sponsors is very important to us. So for more information about Truth Radio Network programming, please go to our website. It's truthradio.com. That's truthradio.com. And Truth Radio Network is a private volunteer organization established as a private charitable trust for the purpose of exercising and defending free speech. Truth Radio is not a 501c3 tax-exempt institution, therefore donations are not tax-deductible. But if they were tax-deductible, we wouldn't be free to tell the truth. That's counterproductive to what Truth Radio is all about. So we rely instead upon the financial support of you, our listening audience, to help us pay for our satellite time, our internet, audio streaming, and our overhead costs. And we thank you very much for that financial support. That comes through your donations to Truth Radio here at P.O. Box 344, Napomo, California, 93444. All right, here's tonight's wise old saying. The other line always moves faster. All right, we're talking about Samuel Insull. Insull was the Enron of his day. The company went broke during the Great Depression, and because the company went broke, millions of investors lost all of their money. And Insull was charged with fraud. He was charged with conning all of these people. He was the Ken Lay of his day. But when he went on trial, he took the witness stand. He testified. And unlike Ken Lay, unlike many of these modern day business executives, the CEOs of huge corporations, Insull was an honest man who said, I made some bad business decisions, and because of the depression and because of the events that have, beyond my control, taken all of my money, I'm not guilty of this mail fraud. I'm not guilty of deliberately bilking these people out of their money. Now, I don't deny that they lost their money. I don't deny that the company is broke. But I didn't do it myself. I didn't have any malice of forethought or of any intent to defraud these people. Insull took the stand and testified for himself. Now, most of these defendants, you watch as these trials come up like Martha Stewart, these defendants will not testify. Now, the surest sign that a man is guilty is when he doesn't even deny it. You know, when you tell somebody, when you charge somebody with being a fraud or a charlatan or a crook, and he doesn't take the stand, he doesn't testify in his own defense and deny it, and undergoes cross-examination so that you can test the veracity of his statement, you can rest pretty well assured that the guy's guilty. Many of these people, though, are innocent, and their attorneys give them the advice that they ought not to take the witness stand. And there's a basic, sound, logical reason why. And that's because 85% of all criminal defendants are, in fact, guilty. I mean, that's just where reality's at. Now, the police make mistakes. The police arrest 15% of the people who are innocent, 85% who are guilty. So it's just a numbers game. And so the law schools teach every lawyer, always keep your client off the stand. Because if a man is guilty and he is subjected to cross-examination, we will very shortly prove it. Cross-examination is the most valuable skill. It's the most beneficial tool of both the prosecutors and the defense attorney. And that's because you cannot lie and hide it from a skilled cross-examiner. Well, Insull was able to get on the witness stand and tell the truth. Well, next in September of 1929, the Insull, or Samuel Insull, created another investment company. It was a corporation securities company of Chicago. An offering circular was mailed to potential investors, and despite the Black Friday stock market crash, just 5 days later, people's faith in Samuel Insull was so strong that within a year, the public had bought $100 million of these new securities. But the Great Depression steadily overpowered the Insull empire, and by 1932, his holding companies were petitioning for bankruptcy. The operating companies, Commonwealth Edison, People's Gas, and Public Service of Northern Illinois, survived, with Insull still in charge. In June, however, he resigned, citing ill health and advanced age. He was 73, and he and his wife sailed for Europe. Well, by September, word reached Insull in Paris. His affairs were under investigation. The Insulls moved to Greece, which had no treaty of extradition with the United States. Accountants announced findings. Investors in Middle West Utilities had lost more than $700 million. Those in corporation securities had lost $85 million. Collateral had been cross-loaned between the Insull companies. Favored creditors had been given preference. Millions in questionable brokerage fees had been taken from assets. Padded payrolls had included Insull's relatives and friends. Immense secret profits had been paid to as many as 1,600 favorites. They had bought 250,000 shares of Insull Utility Investments common stock at $12 before it opened at $30 and zoomed to $147. Selling at only the opening price would have produced $4.5 million in profits. And that's what the auditors discovered. Now, a Cook County grand jury indicted Insull and his brother Martin for embezzlement from the Middle West Utilities Company and the Mississippi Valley Utilities Investment Company. Then, a federal grand jury indicted Insull and 16 others, including Sam Jr., who had joined his father's business in the 1920s, and Harold L. Stewart for using the mails to defraud. Insull disappeared. Congress passed a special bill which allowed U.S. authorities to arrest Insull in any country where it had extraterritorial rights. Found aboard a ship which was bound for Egypt, he was arrested in Istanbul, Turkey, and returned under heavy guard to the United States. United States Attorney Dwight H. Green's opening at the trial on October the 2nd, 1934, charged that the defendants, through Utility Securities Company, fraudulently schemed to induce investors nationwide to buy the common stock of Corporation Securities Company at inflated prices. Now, he also charged that Insull-controlled companies had maintained a fictitious market for the common stock, thus misleading prospects as to its value. To carry out the scheme, the defendants had used the mails to send circulars to those that they intended to defraud. My God, doesn't that sound like Global Crossing, Enron, MCI, and all of these various and sundry corporate scandals that we've seen over the last 2 or 3 years? And you thought this was something new. And Congress is jumping up and down saying, my God, we need new legislation. This case here produced the Securities and Exchange Commission. And every time one of these events transpires, Congress jumps into the act and starts passing a lot of new laws. Makes us all feel better, I guess. But remember, Insull now is going to be found not guilty. What is he going to do? Here's a story, here's a lesson for Ken Lay and all of the corporate executives that have now been indicted and who are about to be prosecuted for essentially the same thing that Samuel Insull did. Well, what did Insull do to get off the hook? What was the secret that won the case? Well, the jewels of the Insull empire. 80 witnesses identified books and records. Another 50 witnesses had been solicited and bought stock. As countless company names became blurs in jurors' minds, the big picture grew very clear. The government was out to prove that Insull's success had been gained repeatedly by having one Insull Electric Company sell properties to another Insull Electric Company at a splendid profit. It was a pyramid scheme. It was a Ponzi, with the second company then selling to the third company. The holding companies, the securities of which were proclaimed by a Halsey Stewart salesman as the jewels of the Insull empire. And the investment companies had been created to expand the bubble until the depression deflated everything. Now, the specific charge against Samuel Insull and his cronies was that the circular mailed by Halsey Stewart and Company inviting subscribers to buy stock in corporation securities was false and deceptive. The company, it said, would open with $80 million in assets, whereas it actually had only a bank loan of $3.5 million and 304,000 shares of Insull Utility Investments, for which it had paid $7 million. And the circular failed to state that most of the stock that the company intended to buy was common stock, paying only a stock dividend, not cash. Well, Chief Defense Lawyer Floyd E. Thompson, a highly respected former Illinois Supreme Court justice, skillfully brought out his client's English training in business, his success with Thomas Edison and General Electric, the vast savings in the cost of electricity in his power pool, and that the power pool had generated, and it was a modern marvel of business, and his accumulation of utility companies to assure their continuing control and hold off government ownership. Well, Insull further testified that divisions of stock were in line with prevailing corporate practice, that stock dividends rather than cash were common and represented earnings plowed back to increase equity value as to the offending circular. Insull said its statement of assets was based on completion of financing, which was entirely in accordance with market practice at that time. Next, Insull testified on the buoyant optimism of the financial community in March of 1930 after the crash, and on how the corporation securities company's portfolio depreciated $45 million in late 1930, then appreciated $86 million in early 32, when people thought the depression was over. He and his associates had done nothing unusual in supporting the market. He said even the United States did it for government bonds, and he himself had borrowed $5 million to bolster Corporation Securities Company and then borrowed $1 million from General Electric to reduce the bank loan. But by April of 1932, his holding companies had gone into receivership. To avoid bankruptcy, he had given his creditors everything he had, and he now owned no property, no income, and depended on his son for food, clothing, and shelter. What a difference. We'll have to leave right there. We'll be back next time to complete the pyramid scheme. We'll talk about pyramiding and funds next time. Hey, stand by. We'll be back in 3 minutes at the top of the hour, and then we got a 5 minute editorial. And we'll be back with the editorial review with news. So stand by. I'll be right back.